Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Our guest is Art Chansky, somebody who's familiar to everybody at WCHL. Every weekday he gives these great sports stories. And he is a prolific author. The latest book is about Dean Smith and Charlie Scott. It's called Game Changers. And Art, thanks for coming to talk to us about it.
Thanks for having me, D.G.
For those of us who grew up in the 60s, 50s and 60s, your story about Dean Smith and Charlie Scott and basketball and the desegregation of our town is one that we kind of can fall into in memory. But for most of the people who are alive and well, this is a strange – or this is new stuff. Can you tell us in a few words about your book and why it's important and why you wrote it?
Well, thank you. It's really important to me. It's the most important book I've ever written because it's not pure basketball. It's part history, it's part sociology, it's part politics, and it's part basketball, all with a kind of a racial overtone because it was an era when the civil rights movement in Chapel Hill and North Carolina interfaced with Dean Smith integrating the Carolina basketball program. So all of those things make it far broader than just a sports book.
Well, give us your elevator speech about telling us the story of the book in just a few words.
Well,
time period, yeah, personalities.
It's basically a story of one decade, the 1960s, and it tells three parallel stories. Charlie Scott.
Or who was Charlie Scott?
Charlie Scott was the first African American scholarship athlete at UNC, a basketball player, and because he didn't get there until 1966, his story starts on the streets of Harlem, and it traces that through his going to Lawrenburg Institute in North Carolina, and that's where Dean found him. And after being frustrated several times in trying to break the color barrier in his program, finally Charlie Scott was, in Dean's mind, smart enough to get in and get through Carolina, good enough to be a star, which would mitigate the racism.
A great talent.
And be seen as a star on campus and not the token black sitting at the end of the bench. And also tough enough to take what he was going to take, some in Chapel Hill, but mostly away in Clemson, Columbia, places like that.
And so that's the part of the story that focuses on an individual, Charlie Scott, an individual who,
right,
in the minds of people of our generation, is a great hero.
So I tell that story starting in New York, and it crosses over and obviously interfaces with the story about UNC and Chapel Hill and Dean Smith in the mid-1960s.
Tell us the Dean Smith story, even though Dean Smith, before his retirement and death, was, you know, fantastic, well-known by everybody. Now, not everybody knows. Tell us about Dean Smith.
Well, you know, the book debunks three myths. One is that Coach Smith was always a godlike figure. Well, he wasn't in the 60s. He was an unpopular choice to replace Frank McGuire by Bill Aycock in one-man decision. The athletic director was against it, the Rams Club were against it, because, you know, Frank McGuire was a big man about town, big name, and they wanted another big name. So he was an unpopular coach, and for most of the 1960s, he was fighting to save his job. So it debunks the myth that he could do anything that he wanted to, but you saw how he was smart and knew what he wanted to do, but let Robert Seymour, one of the characters in the book, the pastor, first pastor at Binkley Baptist Church, be his mouthpiece a lot on the pulpit and around town, because Dean had to be careful how much he came out in public, because there was a large element at UNC that didn't want him there. And then when he got involved with Charlie Scott, that, you know, kind of brought it to a hilt. And the other myth that debunks is that Chapel Hill was always a liberal place. Well, it really wasn't.
What do you mean it wasn't a liberal place? So you're talking about the university or you're talking about the town?
Both. I mean, it had its liberal elements. There were liberal elements in the faculty, and they were liberal pockets in town, but it was pretty much a southern, old south town like Athens, Georgia, Lexington, Kentucky, Oxford, Mississippi. 30 businesses were closed and were not open to everybody. 19 of them were restaurants. And there was a lot of, debate about that. And many of the people in town wanted the restaurants to be open, but they didn't want to go through the 2.5 to 3 years of daily protests that were begun by five students at Lincoln High School, the all-black high school, it really kind of emulated what had happened in Greensboro with the A&T students at the Woolworth counter 1 month before they went and had a hoo-ha at the old Colonial Drugstore on West Franklin Street, where they went in and ordered and sat down at the booth, which was not allowed, but for black customers.
This was before Charlie Scott got here.
Oh, way before. This was in 1960, and then from that point on, until the Civil Rights Act passed in 1964, Chapel Hill was pretty much under protest the entire time, and. It was a couple of people who really saved it, mainly William D. Blake, the huge, and I mean physically huge, chief of police, who was he was a disciple of Martin Luther King. He believed in peaceful protest. He read a lot about Gandhi, and he believed in that too. And he made sure, to his power, that the protests were handled in a way that violence wouldn't break out, and that the peaceful protesters, could do what they did, but the police also protected them. So he kept the lid on it. A lot of people were involved in trying to make sure that there were a couple of really violent incidents, DG, but nobody was lynched, nobody was shot that we know of. There were no murders, so that was the difference there. And Charlie Scott came 2 years after the Civil Rights Act passed, and it's good that he did, because he would have had a much tougher time had he come earlier.
Well, so all of the public facilities, most of them, by the time Charlie Scott got here, were desegregated.
Yes.
And at least in theory, open to black students, black people. But in the days before that time, is part of the impression is that Dean Smith, the Coach Smith, was helped desegregate the restaurants before the time of the required mandatory desegregation in under the very Civil Rights Act.
Well, that's a myth, too. That's a myth, because I really tell the story about when that happened. He was an assistant coach in 1969 when he and the Reverend Seymour and a black theology student went to the Pines. And at that time, Dean Smith was a kind of relatively unknown assistant coach, but the Agnes and Leroy Merritt, who owned the Pines, knew he was.
Now, what year was this?
1959. Yeah. He had just come. Mm-hmm. So it was actually his first full year. It was the summer of 59. He had been there for one full season as the assistant coach. And they saw that it was Dean Smith, and they thought that if they didn't seat them and serve them, that Dean would tell McGuire, and the Pines would lose all of the basketball team's business, which was all of the pregame meals for home games, all of the pregame meals when they bust to Wake Forest, when they bust to State, when they bust to Duke. It was a huge ticket item for the Pines. So they seated them and served them. And, Dean, he's laughed about it, said, well, people act like I get credit for integrating every restaurant in Chapel Hill. Well, the truth is, he didn't even integrate the Pines, because that was the only minority to be served at the Pines until the Civil Rights Act passed in 1964. And there were documented cases in the book about the protests being held right in the parking lot, the marches right in the parking lot of the Pines, which was a closed restaurant. And there was a fellow named David McReynolds who came down from New York to join the protests, and he spent the night in jail and then went home to New York and wrote a big piece in the Village Voice about Chapel Hill is not quite the enlightened community that some people think it is. And it's it was a pretty negative article that Jim Shoemaker in the Chapel Hill Weekly wrote. And I mean, they just printed completely in its entirety. And
well, Jim Shoemaker wrote the article for
No. David McReynolds.
David Reynolds, and then
but he ran it. He picked it up from the Village Voice.
And so Jim Shoemaker printed it in Chapel Hill in his newspaper.
And Jim Shoemaker was an interesting character in the book, too, because he was a very high-charging journalist in those days. And he wasn't a liberal as much as he was a man of fairness. Like, for example, Chapel Hill did nothing when Brown v. Board passed in 1954. They did nothing for 10 years. Nothing. I mean, a little tokenism here and there. They passed one act when they said, "Well, any first grader who can walk to a school that has opposite race in the school can go to that school. And it turned out that three first graders lived about one block from the old Estes Elementary School. And that was it until Schumacher came out and said, this is all just window dressing. You know, Chapel Hill, you know, needs to, you know, they need to start obeying the law. And so Schumacher was a guy who, you know, was kind of the voice of the town in many ways. And when there was something that was wrong that he didn't like, he came out and said it. I mean, there was a very bad incident at Carlton's Rock Pile down at East Franklin Street, Lower East Franklin Street, kind of where the Siena Hotel sits now, where Carlton Mize had a big sign in the window that said "Whites Only," and the protesters would go there. And this happened, ironically, the juxtaposition of this is pretty interesting. That afternoon, the Carolina football team was in Jacksonville, Florida, beating Air Force in a Gator Bowl, 35-0, and everybody was really excited about that. Well, that night, the protesters marched, over 100 of them, went to the Rock Pile. And they had been there before, and they would go in, and they would order, and Mize would tell them to get out, and they would all sit down. Well, this time, they sat down, and Mize didn't call the police. He locked the front door and he locked the back door, and he went and got jugs of ammonia and bleach and started walking amongst the protesters and spilling them, you know, just dousing them with this burning ammonia and liquid bleach. And the protesters were committed not to reacting. So they just sat there and kind of shook their heads and tried to keep it from going in their eyes and mouth. But what the protesters did, they were in sync with Bill Blake, the police chief. They would tell him, the day that they were protesting, they would tell Blake where they were going and when they would get there and what time.
This is the police chief.
The police chief. What time the police needed to be there to keep something like this from happening. Well, Blake was about 10 minutes late. And when they came in, the doors were locked, but they saw through the windows what was going on. So they banged on the windows and made Mize open the door. And then there were some severely burnt people. And they took those people to the hospital to get them treated with ointment and whatever else. And then they took them to the jail because they were all arrested for trespassing. Mm. And Carlton Mize never got any. I mean, he was never charged with anything because he said they were breaking the law, they were trespassing, and they broke my screen door on the way in. And the Blake's crew actually got there a little late to see what he had done. He saw the results of it. So he wasn't charged with anything. And, you know, so that was a very nasty
story. Did the Rock Pile, after the passage of the legislation, get desegregated?
Yeah.
And how did it work? And how did Mr. Blake deal with, how did the owner deal with this?
Well, the after the Civil Rights Act passed in July of 1964, most of the restaurants, opened up voluntarily. Some of them with some negative comments that, you know, in the book talks, you know, shows how people had still very racist attitudes. But Sandy McClamrock, the mayor, put together a test group where they would go out and test the different places that had been closed just to make sure that they were abiding by now the federal law. And most of them were allowing it begrudgingly, but some weren't. And, the Rock Pile was one that eventually opened up. And Brady's was one that was right next to the Rock Pile. And Brady McClendon was a very known big-time segregationist. And he, it took a couple of years before he said it was his place was open and that blacks could go in there comfortably. That's another thing, DG, is that just because the place was open, it doesn't mean that everybody, you know, blacks and whites went to eat there.
Not a place that you'd want to go if you're black.
Exactly.
You weren't going to feel welcome.
Yeah, totally. Like the Danziger's restaurants, the Ratzkeller and the Ranch House were always open. The Danziger's were, immigrant Jews from Austria, and they came over and opened up these restaurants, and they were always open. But because the Ratzkeller and the Ranch House particularly, which was kind of a high-ticket restaurant, all black staff, all black waiters, the black consumer didn't feel comfortable going in there. And
well,
so You know, and the other thing, too, is that it didn't really – sometimes it didn't have anything to do with the personal feelings of the restaurant owner, like Leo's. He had the Greek restaurant in West Franklin Street. He wanted the town to pass a public –
So he could have an excuse to
He said, if I do it voluntarily, my white trade is going to leave. They're not going to come in, and then I'm going to go out of business. So please pass a law.
Well,
and the one public accommodations ordinance that went before back then it was called the Board of Aldermen. Now it's the Town Council. It was tabled, but just before there were weeks and weeks of debate on it, and petitions signed on two spreadsheets of the Chapel Hill Weekly and everything, and they had meetings in the courthouse, you know, pro and con, a couple of days leading up to the meeting. And when the ordinance came up, Roland Gittes made a motion to table it for further discussion, and everybody said,
"Well,
okay." And so it never really passed. And so Chapel Hill was not really an open town until the federal law passed.
We're visiting with Art Chansky about his new book, Game Changers, Dean Smith, Charlie Scott, and the era that transformed a southern college town. And that, of course, is Chapel Hill, and he and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you join us late, I'm visiting with Art Chansky. Art's the author of many books. I think the one that he loves the most is the one that's just come out called Game Changers, Dean Smith, Charlie Scott, and the era that transformed a southern college town. Art, thanks for being here at WCHL. You look very comfortable being in your surroundings. thanks for letting me come here to talk to you.
In our beautiful new studios. Right?
Yeah,
right, it looks at good. University Place.
It looks good. You can walk by and see the performance if you want to. It's wonderful. Well, you're teaching us about the transformation that took place around the three figures that you mentioned in your subtitle, Dean Smith, the great basketball coach, Charlie Scott, the great basketball player who was the first scholarship athlete at University of North Carolina, and then essentially sort of a non-basketball story about what else was happening in Chapel Hill during this era. And we've talked a lot. I'd love to talk about Charlie Scott a little bit. Mm-hmm. And you've gotten to know Charlie, and you know that I think the myth is that he transformed our attitudes about black athletes, even those of our parents and grandparents, that because he was so good and because he played for us, all of a sudden things opened up for black people. And that he was not only a heroic, but he was also a happy person here. What's wrong with that story?
He was the start of it. And the third myth is that Charlie had a great experience at Carolina. Well, he had a great basketball career, that's for sure. He was a two-time All-American and the first player in the ACC to truly play above the rim. He was that great of an athlete, but he didn't have a very good experience on campus because he was one of 54 blacks of a student body with 13,000. And Charlie was a very self-sufficient kind of survivor from his childhood when his parents split up. His father was an alcoholic. He went to live with his father, who was a cab driver. His mother was tending to his three older sisters.
This is all in New York. He's got no idea about what North Carolina is or where it is or anything.
No idea. This is how the story really starts, telling Charlie's part of it. And he's in East Harlem. And his father loses his cabbie's badge and loses his job and then eventually lost his life to this drinking that he had. So Charlie, from a very early age, and I'm talking DG 13, 14 years old, he had to figure out how to fend for himself. And one thing happened when he was in the eighth grade, a teacher named Mrs. Jarrett recognized that this kid was pretty smart, and she wanted him to take this standardized high school test that one of the top 800 scores, you qualified for these public high schools that had been sort of privatized. We would call them magnet schools today. And you'd get to go to these schools, you know, free or they were public schools, but you couldn't get into these schools unless you passed this test. So Charlie passed the test. He was one of 800 of maybe 15,000 eighth and ninth graders in the city. And very unusual situation, but they told him, you pass this test, you'll pass the SATs. It means you can go to college. And that time Charlie said, well, he thought of him, maybe I'll go into the service after I graduate high school and go into the service. Now he's thinking he'll be the first in his family to go to college. But he's also thinking, well, where am I going to go? How am I going to get there?
Who's well, what it was, did he know he was a good basketball player at this time?
Yeah, he was beginning to play good basketball on the playgrounds. He started off, you know, kind of small, 6 feet, and then all of a sudden he had that growth spurt, and he was playing well in AAU ball. And when he would come to play, and a lot of times the players he was familiar with, who he was playing with and against, would disappear. They weren't there. And he would ask his coaches where they were, and that some of them who were getting to be juniors and seniors in high school were going off to these prep schools so they could get a scholarship. And one of the guys, Earl the Goat Manigault, who was a legend of high school basketball on the playgrounds in New York City, went to this place called Laurinburg Institute. They didn't even know. It's either in North Carolina or South Carolina. That's what they were told. And Charlie said, that's interesting. Would you find out for me who runs that place?
Art, excuse me for interrupting you, right. But at this point in time, in getting in Charlie Scott's mind, he's growing up in Harlem, hadn't had a lot of contact with white people. But he must have heard that in the South, things are pretty bad for black people. And how much about this did he know and deal with when he started thinking about going down to North Carolina to school?
I don't think he knew a lot about it. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, he knew about slaves and the Civil War and everything. But in Harlem, there was no racism because they were all black. So nobody was in danger. Everybody was comfortable. You know, the only biggest trouble they had was when the team from Brooklyn came over and walked into the schoolyard and said, "Let's lace them up, let's go." And I mean, that was the challenge that they had. But so he had the idea that he would go to one of these prep schools, get a college basketball scholarship, and then when he got down there, his father died right away, and he had to go back for the funeral and came back. And Frank McDuffie, who's the headmaster and head basketball coach at Laurinburg, said to him, "Charlie, you don't ever have to go home again if you don't want to. You can stay here. We'll take care of you." And that's where the South sort of became his home. And that's where he met Lefty Dizelle, who was the coach at Davidson at the time, because Lefty would always ask Frank McDuffie, "You got any kids who are good students, can get into Davidson and play for me?" And he said, "Yeah, I do have one, a sophomore who looks like he has potential." And so Lefty invited him to a summer camp after Charlie's sophomore year at Laurinburg, and they became very good friends.
So this is at Lefty's camp. This is Charlie's first real encounter with the overwhelming majority of white people.
Absolutely.
And how did that work out?
Well, he was protected by Lefty because he was a good basketball star and he was being recruited. So, you know, Lefty manipulated everything about him.
So even though at that point in time in the early to mid 60s, everywhere in the South there was this remaining racism and looking down on black people. So Coach Dizelle made it look to Charlie like everything was happy. He somehow or another insulated him. But Charlie got along fine with all these white people.
Yeah, well, there were a couple of black kids in the Davidson community that Lefty got as his friends. There was one girl that he hung out with, so he kind of said, "I had a girlfriend." And, you know, Lefty would invite and then after his junior, he went back to work at Lefty's camp after the summer. And then he committed to Davidson, said, I'm going. And, you know, then he was going to get ready to take the SATs, his score would be high enough that he could get early admissions into Davidson. And then word spread around the South that Lefty got himself a black player and he's a pretty good player and he's good enough to get into Davidson. And so Lefty every time Davidson played in the old Charlotte Coliseum on Independence, a big game, he would invite Charlie down because there were other recruits, and he asked Charlie, basically pick the guys you want to play with, Mike Malloy, Jerry Kroll, Wayne Huckle, all of those guys, Moser, they were all in that class. And so Charlie basically said, I really picked those guys. I told Lefty these are pretty good guys. And Lefty put him in a hotel across the Charlotte Coliseum where it was integrated. He could stay there, but it was right next to a movie theater where the Sound of Music was playing in this prolonged run in the year that it won Best Picture. And Charlie, between the games and hanging out with the recruits, he went to the movies. He saw Sound of Music about 25 times and loved the music and learned every song. And if you go into the North Carolina basketball media guides, all all the way through Charlie's senior year where they have the profiles, you know, favorite food, favorite this.
He's got climb every mountain or something like that.
Favorite actress, Julie Andrews. And he liked it so much, he went back and told McDuffie, who also was head of the choir and the chorus at Lawrenceburg, I think I can sing. I know these songs. I want to join the chorus. So, you know, he was sort of insulated from a lot of things. There was one incident in Davidson after he got there where he and a couple of buddies went down to this little village and the cops pulled up behind him with sirens and flashing lights, and they took him to this house where a woman said that she had been sexually assaulted.
Now, where is this? Davidson and Lawrenceburg?
Lawrenceburg. That she had been sexually assaulted by three young black kids, and they brought the three kids, Charlie one of them, into the house at rifle point. And thankfully, the woman said, no, these aren't the kids. And they let him go, and they ran back to school. And Charlie says in the book, that was my first real...
That's his first real understanding, because in every other environment at Lawrenceburg Institute, which was in the South, but it was all black, at Davidson, where Coach Drizel was... It was mostly white, but it was still
he had his friends, and he was being the thing Charlie liked about it so much is he was being treated like a king down. He had nothing. He said in the book, Lefty did anything for me. He gave me anything I wanted. There was a Davidson grad in Lawrenceburg who lived in Lawrenceburg who gave Charlie his car, and Charlie wrecked it. And the doctor said, don't worry about it. You're okay. So he was insulated from all of that. And that one incident said, well, you know, I better not go off campus anymore, you know. But he liked the attention. It was something that he had never gotten coming from his broken home background. You know, nobody had fawned over him like that. And then there was one incident. There was West Charlotte was a big black high school the biggest and the best that was going to play Lawrenceburg, and they went down to Charlotte for a press conference a week before the game. And after the press conference, Frank and Sammy, his wife Sammy, said, "Let's go up to Davidson. It's only up 20 minutes up the road. You know, let's go see Lefty." So they went to campus and they walked in the basketball office, and Terry Holland, who is now Lefty's assistant, was there and said, "Lefty's eating down at this Greasy Spoon down right off campus. I'll take you down there." So he takes him down there, and they walk in, and Lefty, you know, Lefty, you played for him. Yeah, come on in, you know. And then they walked out, and Sammy McDuffie said, "Lefty, those look like good black eyed peas." And he said, "Well, sit down and order some." So the waitress came over and he ordered, and the food never came, but the owner came over and said, "You know, Lefty, we don't serve the N-word in this part of the restaurant. They got to eat on the other side behind the kitchen." And Charlie wasn't that offended because he had been to that place with his black friend, and they always ate in the kitchen. But the McDuffies were very offended. Mm-hmm. And it really gave Frank McDuffie the opportunity to steer Charlie away from Davidson, or at least let him look at other places. And his hidden agenda was that the first black basketball player at the university, at the state university, would make a much bigger impact than he would at Davidson College.
That made the difference. I tell you what, we got to take a break, okay. But I want to. I'm mesmerized. If you join us late, I'm visiting with Art Chansky about his new book, Game Changers. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Art Chansky, our friend and neighbor at WCHL and in Chapel Hill, and he's written a very important new book on top of 10 or 12 other books that he's written. This is Game Changers, and it's about Chapel Hill, about Dean Smith and Charlie Scott and the transformative era that those folks represented. And we're talking about, I was really interested in this because I have a stake in this story about Charlie Scott's finally deciding to come to Carolina, and I interrupted you just as this critical event took place. I had always thought that you felt like that the restaurant, that is Charlie Scott and his coach being told to go to the other side, to the black side, was that was the reason, but it wasn't the only reason that Charlie didn't go to Davidson and came to Chapel Hill.
No, it wasn't, DJ. I mean, it was really that incident really offended Frank and Sammy McDuffie, and you have to understand that.
Now these were Frank and Sammy
McDuffie. They were a headmaster, Frank, and basketball coach and football coach, and his wife was the math and science teacher, and they were tremendous, and they. And the reason it's important to understand is that their parents, Emmanuel and Tinny McDuffie, were sent to North Carolina by Booker T. Washington when he started Tuskegee Institute. He was getting all kinds of correspondence about all the rampant illiteracy in the South. And so please send people who are literate and can read and write to South and to teach some people, start some schools or whatever. And that's what Frank and Sammy's that's what Frank McDuffie's parents did with Lawnburg Institute. They built a one-room basically schoolhouse out of brick that they eventually took down and used most of the brick to reconstruct the Lawnburg Institute. Frank McDuffie was a person of history. He thought the impact of Charlie Scott going to the University of North Carolina would be better for the state, bigger stage. It would
be better for Charlie, for Lawrenburg Institute, and for everybody except Davidson.
Yeah, more, exactly. more black kids would come to school in the South. More would come to Lawrenburg, and so. When that incident happened, he told Charlie, you've got 10, 12, 15 schools that are wanting you to visit. I want you to pick out some more schools, and I want you to visit them all before you sign anything. And so that's when Dean Smith found out about it, and he called Frank, and he knew Frank McDuffie because he and Harvey Reed, the coach from Elm City High School, had gone to a lot of games, and he had left them tickets, and he asked Frank, what about it? And he said, yeah, we opened up Charlie's recruiting. Since things have happened here, I'll explain to you later, but you better get down here and see him because other people are going to come down. And so, it's a great story about how he sends John Lotz down there one time, and then he sends Larry Brown, who had just seen Rick Mountain, Lebanon, Indiana.
And he says, Charlie's better.
Yeah, he says, Charlie. And then two nights later, he sees Charlie, and he pulls into a gas station at night. He couldn't even wait to get back to Chapel Hill and called Dean Collect at home and said, I saw Rick Mount two nights ago. I saw Charlie tonight. Charlie's better. And Dean said, no. And Coach said, Coach, he's better. He's faster, jumps higher, shoots it. And everybody around me says he's number one in his class, which is the big light that goes on for Dean Smith. Because now
it was a part of our lingering racism, even today, mm-hmm. But especially in the 60s, well, we would sure like to have some of these black athletes, but how are we going to get them to pass the test?
Right.
And it was we understand better now
and Dean,
what that was, yeah. And that, but it was a real challenge for them.
Yeah, Dean was always livid about that because, he always believed that standardized testing was culturally and racially biased based on the secondary, elementary and secondary education the kids got. They weren't prepared to take those tests.
I tell you what, Art Chansky, I've mishandled time. Let's take a quick break and then come back and talk about Charlie's time here in Chapel Hill.
Okay.
Visiting with Art Chansky about his book, Game Changers. He and I'll be right back. Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Art Chansky about his book, Game Changers, Dean Smith, Charlie Scott, and the era that transformed a Southern college town. We've been talking about Charlie Scott. And Art, I forgive me because I've got you off on a path that's maybe more interesting to me than anybody else about Charlie Scott's choosing the University of North Carolina over Davidson. The crux of the book, though, is when Charlie gets here. And the myth is that he was not only clearly a great basketball player that helped transform the Carolina team, but that he was also the kind of guy who, just because he had a great time, he got along well, that this was part of the progress. And you blow up that myth. What was it really like for Charlie?
No, I mean, Charlie, because of being a survivor, he sort of surrounded himself with his own protective cocoon. And he came for Jubilee Weekend, where Smokey Robinson and the Miracles and the Temptations played. Dick Grubauer was his host. They had a great time. He took him to the fraternity houses, and everybody was slapping his back because Dickie told him that this is a great star. It was kind of for the
So again, everybody's being nice to him when he comes to visit.
Yeah.
And he feels comfortable. He walks down Franklin Street.
Absolutely. It's more like the absence of a negative rather than a positive. And he felt more comfortable. And, and he told Larry Brown and John Lotz, when they took him back to Lawnburg, that he liked everything about it. And I could see myself playing there. And that's where they called Frank McDuffie on it and said, you can't, you said Charlie can't sign anywhere until he finishes his visits. And McDuffie said, oh, no. If he wants to sign at Carolina, you can sign at Carolina. And so that told Charlie that Frank had this. He had this ulterior motive, but he didn't force it on him.
Well, I want to back up on that because Frank had a selfish motive, understandably, but he also, and this is hard for me to deal with, but he also felt that this, that coming to Chapel Hill, which although you, as you describe it, it was not as liberal as we think it is, it's probably more liberal and open and diverse than Davidson would have been for him. So it was also in his mind better for Charlie.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was the community was a bigger community at that time. It had a black community. He knew that North Carolina Central was only 10 miles away. There were girls. There weren't any girls at Davidson at the time. So, you know,
what he didn't have was Lefty.
Right.
And you point out in the book that even today, Charlie Scott and Lefty Driesell are tight.
Oh, he was scared to death when he called Joyce Driesell, Lefty was out recruiting, and said, just tell Coach that I love him the best. I'll always love him the best. But Chapel Hill is just a better place for me to go to school. And that's really what it was. And it was Charlie's recognition as a 17-year-old kid to understand all that. And, of course, Coach Smith was recruiting him hard, too, and telling him what a great place it was. And
well, how did it turn out for him at Chapel Hill?
Well, it didn't. I mean, he wasn't like Bill Chamberlain, who came later, who had gone to an integrated school up in Long Island. He was from Harlem, but he went every day. He shuttled out to Long Island Lutheran and was much more ready for it. Charlie was kind of shut down. I mean, when he became a student there, you know, he couldn't go to the Phi Del House with Rusty Clark. He couldn't go to Earing House with Larry Miller to hang out with the football players because everybody would have been uncomfortable. You know, you just have to put yourself in that mind frame back there in the mid-1960s that Charlie was one of 54 on campus, and he started hanging out with a few of the black kids on campus who became the nucleus of the black student movement, who later put pressure on him. So Charlie found out that from those guys that, you know, the social life is at NC Central. It's only 8 to 10 miles away. So Charlie really spent most of his free time when he was at Carolina besides class practice.
There was courted by a fraternity.
Yes.
What's the story on the – but he didn't wound up not being a member of the
– yeah.
What happened?
Yeah, he was rushed by St. Anthony Halls, we know as St. A's at the time, and he was offered a pledge. And it was a story in the New York Times about it that said UNC, North Carolina office, first Negro fraternity pledge or something. And I called – the president was quoted in that story. I looked him up in the database and – called him and he said that, yeah, we recruited Charlie because, not because he was a great player, but he was a great guy and we were really a northern fraternity, you know. But he said, to be honest about it, half the fraternity wanted him and half the fraternity didn't. And Charlie picked up on that and a couple of other things that happened. And he did get a pledge, but he quit after about 3 days. So, you know, it was not and Charlie talks pretty candidly. He doesn't have any – he claims he doesn't have any friends left from college.
Well, know? How does Charlie today – describe this story, and as both as it was, and then as you describe it, is he does he back up and say, "Oh no, I had a real good time here"? Or what?
No. You read the book, you know. He didn't. He says, I was unhappy on campus. I was lonely. He got married after his sophomore year, DG, from a girl who lived in Durham from his hanging out at Central because he was lonely. He was so lonely. And he admits that it was a bad idea to get married, and he, you know, it was a mistake, and the marriage lasted about 2 years. But Charlie will today tell you that he wished that he had more friends from college. He realizes that he went off to play pro basketball, and everybody else went in different directions. So he talks about that, but he is very proud. Very proud to have been the first and to pave the way.
And does he have a loyalty to Carolina?
Tremendous loyalty. He sent two of his children here, his oldest daughter Simone and his first son.
And so on balance, is it fair for us to make Charlie Scott a great hero?
Absolutely a hero, because even when he has his bad days and he thinks that maybe the university didn't honor him the way they should have. And it was because of Dean Smith. Dean Smith didn't want to honor Charlie Sweat because he was black. He wanted to praise him because he was a great student and a great basketball player. But when he feels that way, you know, he has his bad days about that, but he's still extremely proud that he was one of the trailblazers who now Carolina is annually voted one of the best places for minority kids to go to school. And Charlie Scott started all that.
Is an important part of that developing, even though it wasn't so pleasant.
No, and when he gets on when he's in a bad mood about that, his friends say, Charlie, you know, you can't don't go there, because everybody knows it was tough and everybody knows that it was hard, but you did it. You did it. Well, and take pride in that, you know.
Well, maybe a good place to stop. I'm not ready to stop because it's a great story. Thanks for telling it, Art Chansky, in your book, Game Changers, Dean Smith, Charlie Scott, and the era that transformed Southern College Town. Let's do this again because we hadn't even gotten started.
Yeah, when our basketball season gets rolling, let's do it again, and we'll talk about the basketball aspect of this book, which is another whole tremendous.
I can't wait. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to you for listening to D.G. Martin, who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.